You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. And welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 286 for April 17th, 2024. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about field schools and why they seem to be broken. So get your credit card ready, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Bill in a weight room in Northern California or somewhere. No, I don't know.
I'm in Visalia, California. I'm in a weight room. This is what happens at the Holiday Inn Express weight room. You record podcasts. Nice. We're not lifting. Nice. We're recording podcasts.
There you go. And Andrew in California, I assume not in the weight room because I've seen his pictures.
Yeah, I'm not in the weight room, dude. I have others lift weights for me, okay?
Right. We're just starting out this podcast throwing people under the bus left and right, man.
Then we got Doug in Scotland. I got nothing to say about you, Doug.
I'm afraid to say anything right now, man. I'm supposed to like pick on Andrew or something like that, you know.
I know, right? And our topic today is from Heather, who is currently in Southern California. Heather, how's it going?
I'm good. I'm sitting on my couch with pillows. And lots of blankets. Definitely not in a weight room. I'm very comfortable.
Yes. Nice. Well, Doug's the only one not in California because we overnighted last night at a winery in Southern California on our way to the California coast. So we are headed there today. Yeah. All right. So with that, as I mentioned, Heather, you've got the topic for today that we came up with. And what are we doing?
So we're going to talk about the different options of field schools. So I know, you know, this is like the bane of some archaeologists' existence. It's a surprise, I think, for a lot of new students, archaeological students, when they realize they're paying, you know, $5,000-$6,000. Of course, they're sold that is going to be in a beautiful location, somewhere exotic, and, you know, excavate sites that they read a book about in books, you know, and that sort of thing, but you're going to pay a pretty penny to do that. And there's been various different mechanisms that are encouraging the archaeological community to look at field schools in a different manner. And cost is not the only thing. So I thought we could talk about what are the different approaches. One, you know, of course, was COVID. That definitely impacted field schools. Mm-hmm. There's different ways, different perspectives on the efficacy and ethical ways of field schools. And so looking at different options for how does an archaeologist learn in a practical manner their craft? So I thought that would be a nice, interesting conversation, especially considering on this podcast specifically, we have people that have worked all over the world. And so I think, you know, we all have some interesting perspectives.
Yeah, I'm gonna be a little controversial.
What?
Oh, yeah, I know. No, we should ban all field schools.
There you go. It's a good start.
Yeah. Okay, it's a little more nuanced than that. But honestly, like, it's pretty. So especially when you go into like CRM or development-led archaeology or wherever you're calling it in your country, around the world, basically there's always that like you have a degree and we want you to have had like a field school. And ideally a field school in like the country that you're working in, but you know, they'll pretty much accept anything if you're desperate enough for staff. And like, oh man, it's so variable in quality and what you're doing. And really what it comes down to is a couple of weeks of digging experience. Like some UK universities used to have, oh, you needed like 8 weeks to graduate or 12 weeks or something like that. And now most all of them are down to like 2 weeks or like there's no digging requirement whatsoever. And that's just not enough time to do archaeology. And I think it's horrible because you're also putting in like people who have never dug on sometimes like really important sites. And we all know like archaeology, it depends, you know, on the archaeology, the time period and stuff like that. But, you know, they'll give them like Paleolithic cave sites where you need to be excavating at like a centimeter at a time with like some really fine stratigraphy and stuff like that, that basically if you're learning, you have no idea what you're looking at. Like if we all go back to like that first time when we were digging stuff and they're like, oh yeah, 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 look for the change of stratigraphy. And really all you're doing is you're still troweling. You're like, oh yeah, the change. I'm totally finding that as you just keep digging until you overdig and you hope you hit something different, or you don't, or you ask a million questions. You're like, has it changed? Has it changed? Or they point out something that obviously once you're a professional archaeologist, you can see. You're like, oh, yeah, yeah, you can feel the difference with your trowel. But man, I remember going through like field school and being told that. They're like, yeah, can't you feel the difference? And you're like, no. No, I cannot. I have no idea what you're talking about, like the difference in soil and what I'm supposed to be feeling with a trowel and stuff like that. And you're basically dropping people in on like somewhat important archaeology. And I kind of just feel like before you even get to do that, maybe we shouldn't totally get rid of field schools, but like they should actually put you in a sandbox first. Mm-hmm. And like with fake host holes and fire pits. And then like, let you do it. Like, seriously, they should just, behind all anthropology, archaeology departments, there should be a giant sandbox. And you should be, that should be your first experience.
I mean, listen, I'm not going to deny that. I think that the training leading up to a field school should be a little bit more modern. You know what I mean? Maybe not a sandbox, but maybe even something in virtual reality or something like that, right? I mean, something that is non-destructive and non-sensitive and things like that, right? That being said, the tradition of having students, people who are learning, working on real things, potentially sensitive things. I mean, I told you guys this last time, I had my first colonoscopy on Friday, just like a week and a half ago. And was it a week and a half ago? Yeah.
Yay.
It
was.
I know, right? So first off, go do that. Second, there were at least two people involved in that procedure that were being trained, and they didn't specifically tell me that. But when the woman's sticking the IV into my arm and the guy's going, yeah, that looks good. Sure. Yeah. And she's like, are you sure? Does this look okay? And I'm like, does it look okay? It's my arm. And there was somebody else in the procedure room that was also being changed. I don't know what they did because I was out. So who knows? They could have, you know, jammed a camera up my ass for all I know. I mean, I really don't know. But this is, if medical profession can get away with it, I think probably archaeologists can get away with it if it's done in a well-supervised way. And I think that's where the problem lies. And I've always said this, leadership and supervision in archaeology is garbage. And it starts at the universities and then finishes at CRM companies. And it's garbage throughout.
Boy, oh boy, I don't really know how to follow that because it went from like one kind of excavation to another kind of excavation. And also I turned 45 this year. And so that's not too comforting here to find out that that's what's going on, that I'm just like, you know, the crash test dummy there for a lot of other people to. Okay. So yeah, I hear about that. We can go on about that too, but there's other things too that I ran, you know, I started as a professor in 2017, and I think I've ran 4 or 5 archaeological field schools. And so there's other concerns for me. One huge one is curation. Mm-hmm. So we go ahead and excavate so that people can learn how to excavate. And then where are we going to put the stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And that seems to be like it's like a secondary consideration. And I don't know how many field school, you know, deposits or collections are filling up these different repositories because people just needed to learn how to dig, or thought they needed how to learn how to dig, or professors had no reason to even want to do it. They just did it so that they could get out and have some stuff and have a field school. And now as a result of that, there's, you know, collections that are in repositories that didn't, from sites that didn't really need to be dug. There's stuff that are in aging professors' labs as they retire that are just sitting there that take multiple years and have no home, like nowhere to go. The university won't take them anymore. So you can't really rely anymore like you could in the old days on the university taking all the stuff you dug up over 50 years because now they don't want it. Also, a lot of times it was inappropriately acquired, right? So the whole just dig because I want to dig, the laws have changed now. And so some of that stuff you should never have dug. And the university, it's like kryptonite. They don't want to touch it. And then finally, if you were just going to dig at some, you know, museum in Virginia that's, you know, Thomas Jefferson, well, I guess that's a bad one because actually Monticello has an excellent you know, repository. But a lot of these other, you know, if you just want to dig some plantation, they don't have a quality museum. And so if you were just going to dig it all up, catalog it, then hand it off to, you know, whatever plantation, they don't have curation facilities. So you just kind of dug a site for no reason, for fun. And then now it's going to be stuck there for many years. And then the other thing that has been, you know, really difficult to navigate as someone who works at a university is the liability. And it's not just the health and safety. It's like, it's now it has moved into making sure that every student feels good all the time. And if they don't feel happy, then essentially, like, that's a health violation, and that they have, you know, space to, you know, basically complain, right? Like, that we're supposed to be trained mm-hmm. to make sure that every single person feels absolutely 100% comfortable at every minute while they're asleep, while they're working, while they're doing this. And if that doesn't happen, then it's time to, you know, say that that is a problem on the site. I mean, that's different than when I started 20 years ago. 20 years ago, folks just wanted to learn how to dig. Now folks want to learn how to dig while also getting good selfies, while also no one ever saying anything controversial, while also everyone being kind every single second in a way that they feel is kind, without saying any kind of discriminatory remark whatsoever. Otherwise, now we have to waste, you know, 40 minutes a day on a meeting about how someone made a bad joke about some, you know, mummy that, you know, I felt that was, you know, that was really inconsiderate, and that really hurt me, because what about that mummy's descendants' feelings? And you're like, dude, I don't even really know how to respond to that. Like, I don't know what to say, but we're seriously spending 40, 50 minutes talking about the appropriateness of mentioning things. So that's another reason why it's not really worth it. And then the final reason is the cost, right? And it's not just the cost of running the field school, because I'm also trying to pay stipends, and I'm also trying to pay graduate students to work on it, and they cost even more. And the grants have not increased one bit. Mm-hmm. So there's no increase in, like, funding from the main sources, except every student wants to get paid on the whole thing. And in fact, some, you know, they should be getting paid, but the amount they're getting paid is way higher than anyone can actually afford. So they've essentially worked themselves out of a job, right? If I get $500,000 from the National Science Foundation to do something, a huge chunk to curation, but then an even huger chunk paying the students and the graduate students, right? And as more and more field schools go this way, like, it's just really hard to get that money. And, you know, that cash evaporates real quick. So all those things working against professors, you know, and I haven't even gotten to, like, the other more mechanical things with just the university apparatus.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've said quite a lot. I have some responses to several of the things that you were talking about. And so I think we should take that in segment two.
All right. Sounds good. We'll see you after the break. Welcome back to the CRM Arc Podcast, episode 286, and we're talking about the, you know, futility of field schools, sort of,
but not really. They're not futile. They're not futile. No, they're just it's like, we live in a different world is all there is to it, and I think we might have aged out of them.
Yeah, maybe. Heather, you had some comments on the last segment. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say in general first, and I'm just going to tackle the general and then one of the topics. Mm-hmm. In general, field schools, I think, are important if they're done correctly. Otherwise, the field school does not necessarily have to happen in the university setting. I think that, you know, it's different. We have Bill and Andrew, the different altogether, but there's enough field schools out there that from someone who hires staff and needs to make sure that they're doing the work correctly, very few people who come from, you know, who are in field schools are really learning anything that's helpful in the CRM world. And so it's especially if they are digging in another country. And that's not to say that the field school is a bad field school, but it's different. It does not help in the CRM world when you were, you know, excavating in Egypt or Greece. It's or England or Ireland. It's a different excavation method and approach. And so it's not helpful. The only thing that is similar is the general theory, right? And then digging. Like, I can teach you how to put a shovel in a ground or a trowel. You know, it's those things are not, and that's as far as it goes. Then, so what I think really needs to happen, and this is across the board, this is CRM too, because, you know, I just moved companies and there were some collections in the old company lab that I worked at. There were some collections that were there from prior to me working there, 12 years prior, still sitting on shelves because and it's not about what happens after you're done with your excavation. To me, in my opinion, it is a poor research design. It is a poor methodology. And just exactly what Bill said is that it's not even considered what's going to happen on the curation side. Now, I am seeing that more and more now in mitigation measures where they're really thought out. Somebody who thinks that way and is very, much more detailed is actually including these things in mitigation measures, which I think is a good idea to some degree. Sometimes they can be so limiting that it doesn't account for what happens later on down the road. And then you have a lead agency who's saying, no, you got to follow the mitigation measures exactly. Mm-hmm. And they don't work right for the project at hand. However, I do think that creating a research design that handles what happens with everything at the end is essential. Like, you have to have that. I don't understand why somebody wouldn't be thinking that way. But
yeah.
So that has to be part of the research design. And I think reburial is our friend. Reburial to me should be, of course, in consultation with the descendant community, right? But
yeah,
I think reburial is really where it's at. It is what allows us to, you're putting it back where it belongs. Of course, it's not in situ anymore, but you are putting it back in the area that it originally came from. And having bags, you can have hundreds and hundreds of bags and boxes, whatever it is that you use, that just sit on the shelf and they're never looked at again. It's ridiculous. It should go back in the ground, in my opinion. But the number one thing is the research design has got to account for what happens with everything at the end.
Right. But also, if we're talking specifically about field schools here, the design of the field school should be treated like school, right? And it seems to me, because obviously, unless you've taught field schools like Andrew and Bill have, unless you've taught field schools and set up field schools, I just go off of, talking to other people that have been to field schools, and they sound like they're all a lot of basically the same kind of thing, where the primary goal of the field school is to excavate and research a site, typically for a professor, grad student, something like that. That seems like the primary goal. The secondary goal seems like, hey, maybe you'll learn something along the way. Whereas really the primary goal is for the students to go through a checklist of things that, hey, this is my quote on the job training, except it's not a job, you're paying to be there, but it's my first initial training about how to be an archaeologist in the field and how to do this. Where's my checklist of things that I need to do and learn in order to make sure that I've done this? You go to any other class in school and it's like, here's the syllabus, here's what you're going to learn. But you go to a field school and it's like, just shut up and dig and then go get crazy at night, after the digging's over. And it's just like, what's going on there?
I do the syllabus.
Yeah. Well, sure.
Yeah. So I have now with my new company where we are, I've developed a program where we're training archaeologists, for cross-training people in other disciplines, how to become an archaeologist, how to work in the field under the supervision of qualified archaeologists. And we're teaching how to dig, how to excavate, how to sample outside of a site. So it's in an area, you're just learning how to do things in a methodical manner. And so that's how I'm teaching them. I'm not teaching them in a site. We are teaching them in basically, you've ever done an exhibition where you, kind of go to a school and you teach high schoolers for a day what archaeology is about. It's like that, but in a little bit grander scale. And so now I do want to say one thing. When it comes to reburial needs to be done in a very thoughtful way. It needs to be accounted for and recorded so that people understand where the reburial remains are, so that it's not uncovered again accidentally and thought to be something that it is not. So whenever I do reburial, I do it in a very methodical way we have indicator sand. It is clear that this is not a in situ part of the site, and then it's also recorded in the site record. So if you're going to do the reburial, of course, it has to be done in a certain manner.
Yeah. I wanted to go back to what Chris said a little moment ago, because I thought he totally hit the nail on the head in terms of like field schools. You know, field schools are kind of one of two animals. They are either underline field or they underline school. You know what I mean? And the one that you want from the student's perspective is the school one, right? There are field schools that are there to educate you, and they have like a syllabus. They have some sort of lesson plan. They have some sort of we're going to go through this skill set versus getting there and dig, you know, like, mm-hmm. and the idea of like, oh, you'll just learn it, you know, on the fly. And yeah. You kind of do, but it's not the same, you know? And so it's really hard for a student, like impossible basically, to know what flavor of field school they're getting into. And of course, the one you need is the one that is teaching first. And also, a while back, you know, I think Doug, you were talking about like the sandbox approach or whatever. I just wanted to say, to brag about myself again, you know, I know you're very shocked, but I totally do that. Like there's basically an open field where we start, you know, we do like a fake dig just to get the skill set down before we do anything real. So that's actually the sandbox idea, I think, is a really great idea and actually really easy for professors to do if they so choose.
Yeah, Berkeley has one of those too.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually, so if you don't mind, if I jump in there on that comment, because it was going back and bringing this back to Chris's surgical excavation of his bowels or whatever it was. So actually the idea I got from the doing a sandbox actually came from surgery. So surgeons actually have whole kits. They're like fake skin kits and mm-hmm. fake organ kits that they basically practice. And so like, actually the reason I know this is there's a company here in Edinburgh that does it, and their whole thing is like, you know, a pilot needs, you know, like the big commercial pilots need 20,000 hours of flight time before they're allowed to do the Boeing 737 or 47 or, you know, mm-hmm. all that sort of stuff. But surgeons don't. And wouldn't you want your surgeon to have like a lot more than like 5 hours of practice before they open you up? And so that's their whole sales pitch, is it's actually a series of kits for surgeons to practice, like practice sewing up bodies and stuff like that, so you don't end up with all these horrible scars and all these, you know, it's that basic idea. I always thought it was, you know, you could really do it quite easily, because you're digging some pits and then filling them in with different soils so that they're looking for the stratigraphy. I always thought that like, you could do so much more, because, you know, the limit of a field school is it's one site. Now, sometimes field schools in that one site might have a couple of different time periods. It might have that range, but even then you usually don't get a chance to try a bunch of different things. And we all know, like in CRM, even now we could be going out to any sort of site and it could be brand new for us. So like, you know, paleo stuff, I've done North American paleo stuff, but I've never done actually paleo stuff in like the UK. And I would be completely have to start all over again and be a complete loss, even though I'm pretty sure paleo is paleo. Don't tell the paleo people that. But again, it's that idea. It's like you could do a whole range of different things. I just feel like you could also get so much more in, and you could keep it more relevant. Because if you think about it, like, okay, you're doing a field school. And that might be between, you know, your freshman, your sophomore year, or it might be between like your sophomore and your junior year, which means basically you did maybe a couple weeks of digging a year ago, and then you usually don't do it after you've graduated. So you've basically gone like, yeah, okay, technically you learned how to dig and you did a couple of weeks, but you've probably forgot most of that over a year or two. So by the time you actually get to the job, I think there's a lot of loss there, and it would just be easier if, like, you know, here's your diploma and here's 20 hours of free dig time in the sand pit out back before you go to work or something, you know, like a way to refresh your skills. And honestly, I know we're talking field schools, but we probably should also do this for like CRM as well, because, you know, you can go months if not years between like digging or digging a particular site.
Speak for yourself.
I think skills refresher is a great idea. Yeah. We do that in the scuba diving industry.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's interesting is those are combinations of things that are already kind of put together where I work, but haven't really been fully fleshed out. So they're the archaeological research facility here at UC Berkeley. It's now in an old frat house. And so in the courtyard, they did an archaeological excavation and they left one corner of it still open with, you know, replica artifacts, right? So there's, you know, mammal bone. So there's cow bone. There's other stuff. There's, you know, flakes and other tools that students have made that are modern. There's bottles and stuff that are antiques that are kind of in there. And so you practice mapping. They don't really dig in that, but they practice mapping in that thing. But the other thing about identifying artifacts from different, you know, time periods, we have these kits that we take to elementary schools and show them these different kinds of artifacts from, you know, indigenous California, Mexican, Hispanic colonial California. We have, you know, ancient Rome ones. We don't really have paleo because there's a lot of sharp rocks in there, right? These are kids. But we do have, you know, kind of replica ceramics, other things that are, you know, similar ceramics that they might have found in Spanish colonial California, things that are replicas of projectile points and seeds and beans and other things. And then students go through an exercise where there's, you know, a box that we create together that has kitty litter, unused kitty litter in it. I got to clarify, unused kitty litter. And they use their brushes to brush away the, you know, stuff and identify those things. And after about 6 or 7 minutes, you know, when they have a handful of things, you ask them questions like, well, why do you think there would have been this, you know, rib bone in there? Why do you think that there would have been these beans in there? Why do you think there's a ceramics? What do you think people could have used it for? And then kids go through the motions and then we talk to them about, you know, sediments and artifacts and everything. And then they move on to the next station. They go to ancient Rome and then they move on to the next one. It's like, you know, 1800s California. So if you could mix those things together, right? And then just, you know, teach students with these different sandbox things, but then they also have a mapping thing. And then, you know, there's a massive lab full of, you know, training collections that we have. They can actually see real, you know, Mahalika and real things in the lab. Like that, I think putting that whole thing together could replicate a field school in a lot of ways.
All right. Yes. Good points. I'm sure we've all got comments on that. Let's do that in our final segment on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. All right, welcome back to the Sierra Mark podcast, episode 286. We're talking field schools. And Doug, you have some personal experience you want to relate to the audience.
Well, it was off of Bill's sort of different ways of doing it. And weirdly enough, just what he was describing on ways of going about it reminded me of actually high school. So I was lucky enough that one, it was a massively large high school. We had 3,000 plus kids. And one of our teachers was an old, well, he used to do CRM. And so he taught an anthropology and archaeology class that we could take as some of our electives. And one of the things that he had us do was broke us up into teams. And then we actually created situations or civilizations or whatever you want. We basically create an archaeological site. At the time, like the high school's out in the middle of the mesa, out in the middle of nowhere. And basically, each group would go out and we'd like create artifacts, bury them, and then the other team would excavate them. And then the different teams would compare and be like, all right, so this is what we excavated, and this is the story we think we came up with, and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, because like we're in high school and you know, we knew very little and you were actually trying to create what you thought the evidence would be. All the stories never lined up, which is a fun exercise because, like, you know, the one group would be like, oh, yeah, we thought this was this. And you're like, yeah, actually, no, 100% totally different and stuff like that. But it was actually a fairly interesting exercise. And it sort of reminded me of what Bill was talking about. It could be something that, you know, people can do with projects is you actually have the students think about, it is a pretty good exercise thinking about like what would survive, what would you think the evidence would be, and then seeing if actually someone else can see that evidence and interpret it in the same way. I suspect it'll be fairly similar to what we ended up with, which is completely different, wild stories, not related at all to what we thought it was going to be. But there are a lot of ways where you can engage students to actually create the very sites that they're going to be excavating and get the practice that way.
Andrew does a really great exercise in his class where he has, it's funny because if you have no idea what's going on and you haven't been told, you could get yourself into a lot more work. But so he tells everybody to, you know what, let's have dinner together. Everybody bring your food. We're going to, you know, I'll lecture. We'll have kind of a informal type of class but we'll have dinner. Like, everybody bring your dinner and it'll be fun. And then you show up and then you eat and he's talking and then he says, okay, nobody throw anything away. Now, I don't know if you've changed what you know,
I have a little, but like, I don't shock them anymore because,
okay.
because dude, Heather, I'm just like too popular and my classes were getting too big, but the idea is the same, right? The idea is basically to record, I call it the lunch project. It's like, to record the remains of your lunch. So you got to stop, like put it down, and then you're like wrappers or whatever. You got to like draw your wrapper to scale. You got
everything.
Yeah, you got to list all the attributes and all that. And then you do a little like two paragraph summary of what does this tell you if archaeologists were digging 1,000 years in the future? What does this say of this culture? Your granola wrapper. Yeah, that one goes pretty good.
Yeah, the nicest or the most healthy food, like if you do a salad with a fork and a knife, you're in more trouble if you eat healthy than if you eat crappy food.
It's hilarious. So, yeah, every time.
If you come in with a burrito, right, all you have is a foil wrapper. Lucky you. I had a salad, so I had all these utensils and a tin thing. It was foolish. Foolish.
But no, it gets him to think. It's like, you know, what Doug and you know, others of us are saying. It's like it gets you to think in that archaeological mindset, and you don't have to be like at the archaeology site. Yeah, that one works good, you know, and it behooves us like me and Bill and others just to try this stuff out because sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You know, I've had other things I've tried. I'm like, that didn't work worth a damn. But the lunch project works pretty.
I like it.
Pretty good.
I think it's a really good example of we have to be intentional in what the practical experiences we're giving students and what the field school is for. So if the field school is the opportunity for the professor to have free labor or paid, people are actually paying to labor to work on their project. And that is, if that's what it is, it is what it is. And on the part of it, they get an opportunity to learn along the way. That's fine. But I think there needs to be an intentional method to the creation of these field schools.
Right.
So, the field school cannot just be, okay, we're digging holes. And I mean, I understand. You never know sometimes what you're going to encounter, right, as an archaeologist. And that's part of the learning process. But if you go out there and let's say you have no curriculum along with it. And I see a lot of field schools like that.
The key word you said was curriculum. They either have a curriculum or they don't.
Yeah. And I think that there are different, it could be bitten off in smaller segments. So if you have curriculum and you're using these practicums, right? These practical lessons throughout maybe the semester. So it's not a field school where you actually go away. I mean, there's so many different ways of doing this where you're actually teaching the archaeologists what they're going to need in a practical sense in the field, whether they go into academia or they go into CRM. And in CRM, I mean, I can tell you there's so few schools that are teaching soils and what it is that you're encountering. How do you read the soils? How do you describe the soils? Mm-hmm. You know, right now, because I'm cross-training certain disciplines, oh my gosh, I love geologists. They're perfect for cross-training archaeology.
Every time. Yeah. My entire career, I've had students who were in geology and they kind of, you know, crossed over to our side or kept both going, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think it's important as we talk, like, again, archaeology is so far behind academic archaeology in terms of teaching this stuff. You know, it's kind of sad. They won't do that just nuts and bolts, fun sort of sandbox thing. But I do want to say the best of all is if you have the two-stage approach is if you do the sort of sandbox, the lunch project stuff, but then work at a real site too. You know, you want, like, if I'm creating the world's most perfect archaeologist, I want all of it. You know, I want the skill set to be in there first, but then I do want them to have real experience and see like, oh, this is what a real artifact looks like in the soil. Because a replication won't look the same. It won't feel the same. Like if all you know is replications, you won't know what's going on in the real world. So yeah, perfect world, you have the two-stage approach.
It's interesting. I've kind of moved into a space where I'm just kind of more interested in just getting contracts with local parks and NPS and other things, and then just hiring students to work on the projects and just training them that way. Yep. Because, you know, as an employee, it's your actual job. I only get people who are serious, not the ones who just want to get Instagram photos on the beach and, you know, monkey around. And they're like, this isn't really for me. And I'm like, doesn't matter. You still have 5 more weeks of being with me. So you get folks who like really want to do it for real. You know, the agencies get help, you know, because they're overwhelmed with how much stuff that they have to do. And then people get their first actual line on their resume without having to worry about it, you know, going through a field school first. And so if it was me, I would just set up, you know, collaborations with local agencies and stuff to just do part of their obligation, since it's a state funded agency helping another one, right? Like it's, you know, people working for one university helping another state funded agency, and then have people get paid, have them learn for real, really survey, see actual artifacts and features in the field, not just a photo, but then learn how to take photos, fill out the site forms. I mean, that's pretty much the dimension I'm moving to instead of going on field schools.
Yeah, my dream or my ambition is, I really think that students should not be paying for field schools anymore. I think they should be paid to go to field schools. And that is totally possible if academic institutions are collaborating with CRM companies, which we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast. But I think it's important, and it's one more way for us to do that. So I think, I agree with the public agency. I think that's a great idea. But if we're looking at academic institutions wanting to have a regular stream of opportunities for excavation, I think CRM is probably going to provide that a little bit more, but maybe a combination of both.
I mean, we've mentioned this, you know, episodes past and stuff like that. And it's one of the sort of those things where like we all have that classic view of the field school where it's actually excavation. And there are occasionally different field schools that will do like survey and monitoring. But that's like, that's also one of the sort of letdowns is like, actually a huge percentage of what work you're going to be doing is actually going to be like pedestrian survey if you're in the States, shovel testing if you're, you know, out east. And then like in the UK, actually like a huge percentage is you're just going to be watching a bulldozer, a backhoe for, you know, weeks on end as it goes through some nice farmers' fields and you find nothing. But that's,
that happens in the States too, Doug.
I know.
And SPPs happen in California too. But yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean,
I'm being very generic here. Yeah. But again, like you should get that whole range of skills. Like it's one of those things like, if I could really like capture the essence of like what your job's going to be like, it's going to be you standing in a field watching a backhoe for like weeks on end and finding nothing. And if you can do that, you could do archaeology. And survive. Yeah. I exaggerate. I joke a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems like there's a lot of ways I think we could be more creative. And you could do pedestrian survey. And you could do survey of areas, you know, as long as you get like landowner permission or whatnot, to do that as a practice. And God, that put people so farther ahead in terms of practical skills of day-to-day.
I do some of that stuff on campus because the campus itself has enough land where you can let them walk for a while and kind of take a compass heading and that kind of stuff. So a lot of professors could just do it. They don't even have to go anywhere. You know, they got large land areas on their campus.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also do pedestrian survey on campus too. And I teach folks how to use compass and how to draw maps and everything with a pencil and a ruler. But then I also teach them how to use the handheld GPS. And you're right. We just walk out the door.
Yeah. And I find that the mapping stuff, the skill sets, that's the better skill set actually than the excavation one. Like that, because when you think of it, I think mapping takes a lot more skill, really. You know, excavation for the most part, it's not that hard after you start it, you know?
I think that's the big difference between you two though, because you guys have done CRM, right? And now you're running field schools and you understand what skills are needed and what to put into a field school. But you know, the biggest disparity we have here is that almost every single CRM job out there requires you to go to a field school, and almost every single field school is run by someone who's never done CRM.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And not that there's not a cross population of skills there, but just understanding how to do excavation and survey and things like that in the context of CRM versus the context of a lifelong academic project, you know, that somebody might retire on. That's a very different way of thinking. I mean, some of the skills are there, but yeah, it's just... Dude, it's not quite the same.
Chris, you nailed it. Like, that's the whole the whole thing.
Yep. And also, I watched the hiring thing too, and there's borderline zero chance of someone who's really good at CRM, you know, leaving to take way less wages and way more shit to go to academia, or them to understand that CRM is way better than this weird little dig that someone else loves so much.
Yeah.
You know, and that they should hire someone based on just their PhD scratchings in the sand. Yeah. Like, it's just crazy. The hiring system is crazy in academia.
Yep.
That's also influences a bit of, you know, I mean, I'll throw out just a little bit of defense of academia is, and we've talked about it, is like, you know, well, as Andrew put it, there's the field and then there's the school part of it. But honestly, like, to get tenure and like the entire system's built around the field part, and the school's just sort of there. Like, academia, most academics don't, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of them don't like teaching. Like, they do teaching because that allows them to do the fun research stuff that they really want to do.
Unfortunately, I think you can say most.
Yeah, I don't want to, but I really do think like teaching just sort of tacked on as the day job. I think that unfortunately just permeates down into all, well, across the entire discipline, across all departments, and all the motivation is basically you have to publish, you have to do this, and that's the fun part, is the digging. The fun part's not doing the curation. No one likes to do curation except curators. That's a whole different discipline. You know, there's all sorts of stuff. It's basically built so that it's meant to be field, not school.
So I agree, but I think there's an opportunity. You don't need to bring on somebody who's CRM that's going to quit their CRM and the money that goes with CRM. Although you hear all the time, there is no money in CRM. That's not true for those that are listening. I don't see why institutions don't bring in, and I have seen it. It does happen where they don't bring in CRM professionals to teach one class or CRM professionals who understand the regulatory side of things to teach one class.
Like Doug said, teaching is the extra thing. None of us are teachers.
Yeah.
No. What I'm saying is, though, if the curriculum, right, they're setting up a curriculum for archaeology. Now, the fact that it isn't like this, that is what it is, but it should be like this. Like, you have these programs, Sonoma State, right? They have a CRM specific program. They should be bringing in actual CRM professionals who are seasoned CRM professionals who've been working in it for a long time, who understand the regulatory side of things and how CRM fits in the regulatory process. And they should be teaching a class specifically on that. One class, that's all it takes. Nobody has to give up their CRM job. And then you're getting an expert who's in it right now, teaching the students that aspect of what they're going into. Like, if you're going to prepare people, that's what you should be doing.
I think you're right. And I think Sonoma State actually does have people. It's everywhere else, right? It's like where I work.
Right.
I don't know about where Andrew works, but.
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah.
But that's like the part of the teaching, though, is they have to do that to get paid. Like, if you're giving over, I know you're saying just one class, Heather. Right. I totally agree with you. I think and we're all on the same page. So it should be not what it is. But I do think part of that is, one, they don't, you know, if they've never done CRM, they don't actually, like, you don't know what to hire. Like, if I wanted to go out and hire a philosopher, I don't know where I'd start. I don't even know if I need a philosopher. I probably do. But, like, it's that same sort of concept of, like, they have no idea. And then there's always that risk of, like, you know, they need to teach certain courses. Who's going to take their time, you know, spend extra time to go find someone to teach a course that they're not going to get credit for, that's not going to count towards their tenure, not going to count towards their paycheck. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot holding it back of what it could be.
Yeah, I would say just one last little thing that I also noticed the flip side of people in CRM might not necessarily be very good teachers either. Like I've seen that where, you know, they don't know how to or take seriously making a syllabus or that kind of stuff. They're out there just like there are in everywhere. But that can be a thing.
We're giving all these excuses. It doesn't have to be that way. If we're intentionally, if we sit down, we're smart people. We're not like, you know, if we sit down and we're actually thinking about what is getting a degree for, it's to prepare you for getting a good job. That's what it should be. Okay. I know in some cases it's to prepare you maybe to be a researcher, but that's also a job, right? But it's in bulk. It should be preparing the students that are in your classes, that are in your program, to go and be prepared to hit the ground running when they enter the field. That is what it should be doing. And I think, I know that that's not the way it is right now, but I think it could change. And I think, you know, there's people on this podcast right here, hosts, that are changing it. And so I do think it can change. And the other thing that I'd like to say, just to finish off this subject, is that we need to really shift things in archaeology. This concept that archaeologists are diggers and monitors, yes, that is an aspect of what we do. But if you as a professional archaeologist are working towards, you want a long-standing career, you should not be focusing on monitoring. Monitoring is important and it should be supervised and it should be considered an important aspect of the job. But it's not just monitoring and it's not just digging. We want people to be shifting as in their careers into something that is much more complex than that. This concept that people want to become an archaeologist, and I think it's because that's what they've been told. They become an archaeologist and then they're just going to excavate. That's what they want, to get paid incrementally more every year, a lot of money to excavate. That's all they want to do is dig and excavate and be in the field. Well, if you want to have this as a long-standing career for your health and for your, as a professional, growing as a professional, you have to be able to write. You have to be able to understand the regulatory process and work within the regulatory process. There's so many skill sets that can prepare you for a good, well-paying job in this discipline. And if you're stuck in this mindset that an archaeologist is an excavator or a monitor, you're being short-sighted and you're not going to go very far in this business. So I think that, again, these field schools need to teach more than just excavation, and it's maybe not field schools, but maybe there should be separate field schools for this regulatory process. Maybe that's where it's at. If we're not going to have a separate class with separate adjunct professors that come in from the professional side, maybe then the field class, there should be a specific regulatory field class. If that's how it needs to happen. But I just think in general, we need to rethink this. We need to rethink it so that we're preparing archaeologists well, so they can have a long-standing career, a well-paid long-standing career, and not that. Yeah, I'm not going to go into the union side.
Welcome to the dark side, Heather. Welcome to the dark side. Job is a change.
Yeah,
Matt, when you were talking about that, Heather, I'll say this last little piece before we shut off is, like, my wife and I have this running joke about, like, every police procedural, like, you know, after like a shooting, which seems to happen like every other episode or every episode, they really should have like the next episode be like the paperwork episode. Cause you know, what you don't ever see is the massive amounts of paperwork. And actually, like, if it was real, like, there'd be a shooting in the first episode of a season and the next 8 episodes is just them stuck in a room doing paperwork and talking to lawyers. Right. But yeah, we also, like, in archaeology, we're in the same thing. We're like, we're always excavation, as it were, is the shootouts, the fun, the police, the arrests, but we never actually do any of the paperwork. Well, and there really should be a paperwork field school.
There should,
where you get locked into a room for eight weeks straight.
It's not that boring. I call me a nerd, but that's actually the fun part. But anyway,
Bill, did you have one last comment?
Yeah. Well, the only thing I wanted to say is, folks who are listening to this, all of us here, we're empowered to make this thing the way we want.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Don't sit around and wait for universities, and don't wait for your CRM company, their boss, to somehow get it right. Like, don't think that somehow money is going to materialize from a CRM company, because they're always whining about money and they never buy assets. And it's like a whole company that never buys assets and then just cries about how they don't have any revenue.
Not all of them.
Just make sure that you know, if you want it to be this way, you find the folks, you put it together, and, you know, they're never going to pay you to get the change that you're looking for. So, you know, professors aren't doing it. Here's a whole network of people who listen to this podcast. There's plenty of people you can join the APN, connect with them. You can find folks in your area to teach you these skills because your school's not doing it. Don't waste your time pushing your professors to hire quality folks, because there's no incentive to get anyone who doesn't just do razzle dazzle, grant funded, you know, epic stuff. So, you know, they don't get it. They're never going to get it. I've been here for, you know, 7 years at Cal. My department will never get it when it comes to hiring people who are going to teach functional skills to get people jobs. I'm telling you from the inside, man, you'll make way more change on the outside doing what you need to do to get what you need to make it in this world than waiting for someone like me who's got a pension, salary, and all that stuff. And, you know, no one, there's no motivation, nothing. I will get no penalty from teaching people just gibberish. I can do it for the next, until I decide to retire, you know, eternity. Yeah. So don't wait for me. Don't wait for others. You know, find folks on the outside, build your own thing, use the APN, use social media, use whatever it takes, meet people in real life, learn skills, get work, get jobs.
Amen. Can I get an amen to Bill there?
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, hey, if anybody listening to this has any comments, we'd love to hear those. You know, post this on social media. We don't generally do that because we're on the show and, you know, pages don't generally like that. But we're post it wherever you're wanting to hear some comments, and then also respond to us at the APN. So arcpodnet.com. All right. With that, we will see you guys next time.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Goodbye.
Yeah, see, it's edited out. It's cut. It's done.
What do you mean it's cut? Well, just get goodbye. Or do you need a third take? Goodbye. I'm going to give you all sorts of work with, Chris. Bye, bye, bye.
Mm-hmm.
Adios. Okay.
See you guys next time.
Adios.
Bye.
You're all doing it now? Can I say my piece so we can get it on the recording now?
Yes,
please.
All right. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
See, Chris, we took Bill's speech to heart, and we didn't wait for you to do it.
That's right. You know, my wife's editing these now, so you just gave her a ton of work. I'm just saying.
No.
Leave this in.
I believe it. 100%.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.